Side 4, The Way of Zen, continuing on page 106. The koan system was developed in the Linji, Rinzai school of Zen, but not without opposition. The Soto school felt that it was much too artificial. Whereas the koan advocates used this technique as a means for encouraging that overwhelming feeling of doubt, yi jing, which they felt to be essential as a prerequisite for satori, the Soto school argued that it lent itself too easily to that very seeking for satori which thrusts it away, or, what is worse, induces an artificial satori. Adherents of the Rinzai school sometimes say that the intensity of the satori is proportionate to the intensity of the feeling of doubt, of blind seeking which precedes it, but for Soto this suggests that such a satori has a dualistic character, and is thus no more than an artificial emotional reaction. Thus the Soto view was that proper dhyana lay in motiveless action, wu wei, in sitting just to sit, or walking just to walk. The two schools, therefore, came to be known respectively as Kanhua Zen, observing the anecdote Zen, and Mojao Zen, silently illumined Zen. The Rinzai school of Zen was introduced into Japan in 1191 by the Japanese Tiantai monk Eisai, 1141-1215, who established monasteries at Kyoto and Kamakura under imperial patronage. The Soto school was introduced in 1227 by the extraordinary genius Dogen, 1200-1225, who established the great monastery of Eiheiji, refusing, however, to accept imperial favors. It should be noted that Zen arrived in Japan shortly after the beginning of the Kamakura era, when the military dictator Yoritomo and his samurai followers had seized power from the hands of the then somewhat decadent nobility. This historical coincidence provided the military class, the samurai, with a type of Buddhism which appealed to them strongly because of its practical and earthy qualities and because of the directness and simplicity of its approach. Thus there arose that peculiar way of life called Bushido, the Tao of the warrior, which is essentially the application of Zen to the arts of war. The association of the peace-loving doctrine of the Buddha with the military arts has always been a puzzle to Buddhists of other schools. It seems to involve the complete divorce of awakening from morality. But one must face the fact that, in its essence, the Buddhist experience is a liberation from conventions of every kind, including the moral conventions. On the other hand, Buddhism is not a revolt against convention, and in societies where the military caste is an integral part of the conventional structure, and the warrior's role an accepted necessity, Buddhism will make it possible for him to fulfill that role as a Buddhist. The medieval cult of chivalry should be no less of a puzzle to the peace-loving Christian. The contribution of Zen to Japanese culture has by no means been confined to Bushido. It has entered into almost every aspect of the people's life, their architecture, poetry, painting, gardening, their athletics, crafts, and trades. It has penetrated the everyday language and thought of the most ordinary folk. For by the genius of such Zen monks as Dogen, Hakuin, and Bankei, by such poets as Ryokan and Basho, and by such a painter as Sesshu, Zen has been made extraordinarily accessible to the common mind. Dogen in particular made an incalculable contribution to his native land. His immense work, the Shobogenzo, Treasury of the Eye of the True Doctrine, was written in the vernacular and covered every aspect of Buddhism from its formal discipline to its profoundest insights. His doctrine of time, change, and relativity is explained with the aid of the most provoking poetic images, and it is only regrettable that no one has yet had the time and talent to translate this work into English. Hakuin, 1685-1768, reconstituted the koan system and is said to have trained no less than 80 successors in Zen. Bankei, 1622-1693, found a way of presenting Zen with such ease and simplicity that it seemed almost too good to be true. He spoke to large audiences of farmers and country folk, but no one important seems to have dared to follow him. Meanwhile, Zen continued to prosper in China until well into the Ming dynasty, 1368 to 1643, when the divisions between the various schools of Buddhism began to fade, and the popularity of the Pure Land school, with its easy way of invoking the name of Amitabha, began to be fused with koan practice, and at last to absorb it. A few Zen communities seem to have survived to the present day, but so far as I have been able to study them, their emphasis inclines either to Soto or to the more occultist preoccupations of Tibetan Buddhism. In either case, their view of Zen seems to be involved with a somewhat complex and questionable doctrine of man's psychic anatomy, which would appear to derive from Taoist alchemical ideas. The history of Chinese Zen raises one problem of great fascination. Both Rinzai and Soto Zen, as we find them in Japanese monasteries today, put enormous emphasis on Zazen, or sitting meditation, a practice which they follow for many hours of the day, attaching great importance to the correctness of posture and the way of breathing which it involves. To practice Zen is, to all intents and purposes, to practice Zazen, to which the Rinzai school adds Sanzen, the periodic visits to the master, Roshi, for presenting one's view of the koan. However, the Shen Wei, Ho Zhang Yiqi, records the following conversation between Shen Wei and a certain Cheng. The master asked Dhyana Master Cheng what method must be practiced to see into one's own nature. It is first of all necessary to apply oneself to the practice of sitting cross-legged in samadhi. Once samadhi is obtained, one must, by means of samadhi, awaken prajna in oneself. By prajna, one is able to see into one's own nature. Shen Wei. When one practices samadhi, isn't this a deliberate activity of the mind? Cheng. Yes. Shen Wei. Then this deliberate activity of the mind is an activity of restricted consciousness, and how can it bring seeing into one's own nature? Cheng. To see into one's own nature, it is necessary to practice samadhi. How could one see it otherwise? Shen Wei. All practice of samadhi is fundamentally a wrong view. How, by practicing samadhi, could one attain samadhi? We have already mentioned the incident between Ma Zhu and Huai Rong, in which the latter compared sitting in meditation to polishing a tile for a mirror. On another occasion, Huai Rong said, "To train yourself in sitting meditation, Zazen, is to train yourself to be a sitting Buddha. If you train yourself in Zazen, you should know that Zen is neither sitting nor lying. If you train yourself to be a sitting Buddha, you should know that the Buddha is not a fixed form. Since the Dharma has no fixed abode, it is not a matter of making choices. If you make yourself a sitting Buddha, this is precisely killing the Buddha. If you adhere to the sitting position, you will not attain the principle of Zen." End of quote. This seems to be the consistent doctrine of all the Tang masters, from Hui Neng to Lin Ji. Nowhere in their teachings have I been able to find any instruction in or recommendation of the type of Zazen which is today the principal occupation of Zen monks. On the contrary, the practice is discussed time after time in the apparently negative fashion of the two quotations just cited. It could be assumed that Zazen was so much the normal rule of the Zen monk's life that our sources do not bother to discuss it, and that their teachings are designed solely for advanced students who have so mastered Zazen that the time has come to go beyond it. This, however, does not agree too well with the references to the enormous clerical and lay audiences attending some of the discourses, since it would be somewhat fantastic to suppose that China was swarming with accomplished yogis. The discourses frequently begin by saying, in a rather brief and offhand fashion, that these teachings are for those who are well trained in the Buddhist virtues. But this could mean no more than that they are for mature people who have mastered the ordinary social and moral conventions, and are therefore not in danger of using Buddhism as a pretext for rebellion against the common decencies. Alternatively, it could be assumed that the type of Zazen under criticism is Zazen practiced for a purpose, to get Buddhahood, instead of sitting just to sit. This would concur with the Soto objection to the Rinzai school with its method of cultivating the state of great doubt by means of the koan. While the Soto is not quite fair to the Rinzai in this respect, this would certainly be a plausible interpretation of the early master's doctrine. However, there are several references to the idea that prolonged sitting is not much better than being dead. There is, of course, a proper place for sitting, along with standing, walking, and lying, but to imagine that sitting contains some special virtue is attachment to form. Thus, in the Tanjing, Huineng says, "A living man who sits and does not lie down, a dead man who lies down and does not sit. After all, these are just dirty skeletons." Even in Japanese Zen, one occasionally encounters a Zen practice which lays no special emphasis upon Zazen, but rather stresses the use of one's ordinary work as the means of meditation. This was certainly true of Bankei, and this principle underlies the common use of such arts as tea ceremony, flute playing, brush drawing, archery, fencing, and jujitsu as ways of practicing Zen. Perhaps, then, the exaggeration of Zazen in later times is part and parcel of the conversion of the Zen monastery into a boys' training school. To have them sit still for hours on end under the watchful eyes of monitors with sticks is certainly a sure method of keeping them out of mischief. Yet, however much Zazen may have been exaggerated in the Far East, a certain amount of sitting, just to sit, might well be the best thing in the world for the jittery minds and agitated bodies of Europeans and Americans, provided they do not use it as a method for turning themselves into Buddhas. Part 2. Principles and Practice. Chapter 1. Empty and Marvelous. The opening words of the oldest Zen poem say that the perfect way, Dao, is without difficulty, save that it avoids picking and choosing. Only when you stop liking and disliking will all be clearly understood. A split hair's difference, and heaven and earth are set apart. If you want to get the plain truth, be not concerned with right and wrong. The conflict between right and wrong is the sickness of the mind. The point is not to make an effort to silence the feelings and cultivate bland indifference. It is to see through the universal illusion that what is pleasant or good may be wrested from what is painful or evil. It was the first principle in Taoism that when everyone recognizes beauty as beautiful, there is already ugliness. When everyone recognizes goodness as good, there is already evil. To be and not to be arise mutually. Difficult and easy are mutually realized. Long and short are mutually contrasted. High and low are mutually posited. Before and after are in mutual sequence. To see this is to see that good without evil is like up without down, and that to make an ideal of pursuing the good is like trying to get rid of the left by constantly turning to the right. One is therefore compelled to go round in circles. Note, believe it or not, there is actually a politician in San Francisco who so detests the political left wing that he will not make a left turn with his car. End of note. The logic of this is so simple that one is tempted to think it over simple. The temptation is all the stronger because it upsets the fondest illusion of the human mind, which is that in the course of time everything may be made better and better. For it is the general opinion that were this not possible, the life of man would lack all meaning and incentive. The only alternative to a life of constant progress is felt to be a mere existence, static and dead, so joyless and inane that one might as well commit suicide. The very notion of this only alternative shows how firmly the mind is bound in a dualistic pattern, how hard it is to think in any other terms than good or bad, or a muddy mixture of the two. Yet Zen is a liberation from this pattern, and its apparently dismal starting point is to understand the absurdity of choosing, of the whole feeling that life may be significantly improved by a constant selection of the good. One must start by getting the feel of relativity, and by knowing that life is not a situation from which there is anything to be grasped or gained, as if it were something which one approaches from outside like a pie or a barrel of beer. To succeed is always to fail, in the sense that the more one succeeds in anything, the greater is the need to go on succeeding. To eat is to survive, to be hungry. The illusion of significant improvement arises in moments of contrast, as when one turns from the left to the right on a hard bed. The position is better, so long as the contrast remains. But before long, the second position begins to feel like the first. So one acquires a more comfortable bed, and for a while sleeps in peace. But the solution of the problem leaves a strange vacuum in one's consciousness, a vacuum soon filled by the sensation of another intolerable contrast hitherto unnoticed, and just as urgent, just as frustrating as the problem of the hard bed. The vacuum arises because the sensation of comfort can be maintained only in relation to the sensation of discomfort, just as an image is visible to the eye only by reason of a contrasting background. The good and the evil, the pleasant and the painful, are so inseparable, so identical in their difference, like the two sides of a coin, that fair is foul and foul is fair. Or, in the words of a poem in the Zenrin Kushu, to receive trouble is to receive good fortune. To receive agreement is to receive opposition. Note, the Zenrin Kushu is an anthology of some 5,000 two-line poems compiled by Toyo Echo, 1429-1504. Its purpose was to provide Zen students with a source book of verses from which to select couplets expressing the theme of a newly solved koan. Many masters require such a verse as soon as the proper answer to the koan has been given. The couplets have been drawn from a vast variety of Chinese sources, Buddhist, Taoist, classical literature, popular songs, etc. End of note. Another puts it more vividly. At dusk, the cock announces dawn. At midnight, the bright sun. Zen does not, for this reason, take the attitude that it is so futile to eat when hungry that one may as well starve, nor is it so inhuman as to say that when we itch we should not scratch. Disillusionment with the pursuit of the good does not involve the evil of stagnation as its necessary alternative, for the human situation is like that of fleas on a hot griddle. None of the alternatives offer a solution, for the flea who falls must jump, and the flea who jumps must fall. Choosing is absurd, because there is no choice. To the dualistic mode of thought, it will therefore seem that the standpoint of Zen is that of fatalism as opposed to free choice. When Muju was asked, "We dress and eat every day, and how do we escape from having to put on clothes and eat food?" he answered, "We dress, we eat." "I don't understand," said the monk. "If you don't understand, put on your clothes and eat your food." On being asked how to escape from the heat, another master directed the questioner to the place where it is neither hot nor cold. When asked to explain himself, he replied, "In summer we sweat, in winter we shiver." Or, as a poem puts it, "When cold, we gather round the hearth before the blazing fire. When hot, we sit on the bank of the mountain stream in the bamboo grove." And from this point of view, one can see the sun in the midst of the rain, scoop clear water from the heart of the fire. But the viewpoint is not fatalistic. It is not simply submission to the inevitability of sweating when it is hot, shivering when it is cold, eating when hungry, and sleeping when tired. Submission to fate implies someone who submits, someone who is the helpless puppet of circumstances, and for Zen there is no such person. The duality of subject and object, of the knower and the known, is seen to be just as relative, as mutual, as inseparable as every other. We do not sweat because it is hot. The sweating is the heat. It is just as true to say that the sun is light because of the eyes as to say that the eyes see light because of the sun. The viewpoint is unfamiliar because it is our settled convention to think that heat comes first, and then by causality the body sweats. To put it the other way round is startling, like saying cheese and bread, instead of bread and cheese. Thus, the Zenrin Kushu says, fire does not wait for the sun to be hot, nor the wind for the moon to be cool. This shocking and seemingly illogical reversal of common sense may perhaps be clarified by the favourite Zen image of the moon in the water. The phenomenon, moon in the water, is likened to human experience. The water is the subject, and the moon the object. When there is no water, there is no moon in the water. And likewise, when there is no moon. that when the moon rises, the water does not wait to receive its image, and when even the tiniest drop of water is poured out, the moon does not wait to cast its reflection. For the moon does not intend to cast its reflection, and the water does not receive its image on purpose. The event is caused as much by the water as by the moon, and as the water manifests the brightness of the moon manifests the clarity of the water. Another poem in the Zen Rinkushu says, "Trees show the bodily form of the wind. Waves give vital energy to the moon." To put it less poetically, human experience is determined as much by the nature of the mind and the structure of its senses as by the external objects whose presence the mind reveals. Men feel themselves to be victims or puppets of their experience because they separate themselves from their minds, thinking that the nature of the mind-body is something involuntarily thrust upon them. They think that they did not ask to be born, did not ask to be given a sensitive organism to be frustrated by alternating pleasure and pain. But Zen asks us to find out who it is that has this mind, and who it was that did not ask to be born before father and mother conceived us. Thence it appears that the entire sense of subjective isolation, of being the one who was given a mind, and to whom experience happens, is an illusion of bad semantics, the hypnotic suggestion of repeated wrong thinking. For there is no myself apart from the mind-body which gives structure to my experience. It is likewise ridiculous to talk of this mind-body as something which was passively and involuntarily given a certain structure. It is that structure, and before the structure arose, there was no mind-body. Our problem is that the power of thought enables us to construct symbols of things apart from the things themselves. This includes the ability to make a symbol, an idea of ourselves apart from ourselves. Because the idea is so much more comprehensible than the reality, the symbol so much more stable than the fact, we learn to identify ourselves with our idea of ourselves, hence the subjective feeling of a self which has a mind, of an inwardly isolated subject to whom experiences involuntarily happen. With its characteristic emphasis on the concrete, Zen points out that our precious self is just an idea, useful and legitimate enough if seen for what it is, but disastrous if identified with our real nature. The unnatural awkwardness of a certain type of self-consciousness comes into being when we are aware of conflict or contrast between the idea of ourselves on the one hand and the immediate concrete feeling of ourselves on the other. When we are no longer identified with the idea of ourselves, the entire relationship between subject and object, knower and known, undergoes a sudden and revolutionary change. It becomes a real relationship, a mutuality in which the subject creates the object just as much as the object creates the subject. The knower no longer feels himself to be independent of the known. The experiencer no longer feels himself to stand apart from the experience. Consequently, the whole notion of getting something out of life, of seeking something from experience, becomes absurd. To put it in another way, it becomes vividly clear that in concrete fact, I have no other self than the totality of things of which I am aware. This is the Huayen, Kegon, doctrine of the net of jewels of Shosho Wu Ai, Japanese Jijimuge, in which every jewel contains the reflection of all the others. The sense of subjective isolation is also based on a failure to see the relativity of voluntary and involuntary events. This relativity is easily felt by watching one's breath, for by a slight change of viewpoint, it is as easy to feel that I breathe as that it breathes me. We feel that our actions are voluntary when they follow a decision, and involuntary when they happen without decision. But if decision itself were voluntary, every decision would have to be preceded by a decision to decide, an infinite regression which fortunately does not occur. Oddly enough, if we had to decide to decide, we would not be free to decide. We are free to decide because decision happens. We just decide. without having the faintest understanding of how we do it. In fact, it is neither voluntary nor involuntary. To get the feel of this relativity is to find another extraordinary transformation of our experience as a whole, which may be described in either of two ways. I feel that I am deciding everything that happens, or I feel that everything, including my decisions, is just happening spontaneously. For a decision, the freest of my actions, just happens, like hiccups inside me, or like a bird singing outside me. Such a way of seeing things is vividly described by a modern Zen master, the late Sokeyan Sasaki. One day, I wiped out all the notions from my mind. I gave up all desire. I discarded all the words with which I thought and stayed in quietude. I felt a little queer, as if I were being carried into something, or as if I were touching some power unknown to me, and, zit, I entered. I lost the boundary of my physical body. I had my skin, of course, but I felt I was standing in the center of the cosmos. I spoke, but my words had lost their meaning. I saw people coming towards me, but all were the same man. All were myself. I had never known this world. I had believed that I was created, but now I must change my opinion. I was never created. I was the cosmos. No individual Mr. Sasaki existed. End of quote. It would seem, then, that to get rid of the subjective distinction between me and my experience through seeing that my idea of myself is not myself, is to discover the actual relationship between myself and the outside world. The individual, on the one hand, and the world, on the other, are simply the abstract limits or terms of a concrete reality which is between them, as the concrete coin is between the abstract Euclidean surfaces of its two sides. Similarly, the reality of all inseparable opposites, life and death, good and evil, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, is that between for which we have no words. Man's identification with his idea of himself gives him a specious and precarious sense of permanence. For this idea is relatively fixed, being based upon carefully selected memories of his past, memories which have a preserved and fixed character. Social convention encourages the fixity of the idea because the very usefulness of symbols depends upon their stability. Convention, therefore, encourages him to associate his idea of himself with equally abstract and symbolic roles and stereotypes, since these will help him to form an idea of himself which will be definite and intelligible. But to the degree that he identifies himself with a fixed idea, he becomes aware of life as something which flows past him, faster and faster as he grows older, as his idea becomes more rigid, more bolstered with memories. The more he attempts to clutch the world, the more he feels it is a process in motion. On one occasion, Madzu and Bojang were out for a walk when they saw some wild geese flying past. "What are they?" asked Madzu. "They're wild geese," said Bojang. "Where are they going?" demanded Madzu. Bojang replied, "They've already flown away." Suddenly, Madzu grabbed Bojang by the nose and twisted it so that he cried out in pain. "How," shouted Madzu, "could they ever have flown away?" This was the moment of Bojang's awakening. The relativity of time and motion is one of the principal themes of Dogen's Shobogenzo, where he writes, "If we watch the shore while we are sailing in a boat, we feel that the shore is moving. But if we look nearer to the boat itself, we know then that it is the boat which moves. When we regard the universe in confusion of body and mind, we often get the mistaken belief that our mind is constant. But if we actually practice Zen and come back to ourselves, we see that this was wrong. When firewood becomes ashes, it never returns to being firewood. But we should not take the view that what is latterly ashes was formerly firewood. What we should understand is that, according to the doctrine of Buddhism, firewood stays at the position of firewood. There are former and later stages, but these stages are clearly cut. It is the same with life and death. Thus we say in Buddhism that the unborn is also the undying. Life is a position of time. Death is a position of time. They are like winter and spring, and in Buddhism we do not consider that winter becomes spring, or that spring becomes summer. From the Shobogenzo, for this translation I am indebted to my colleague, Professor Saburo Hasegawa. Dogen is here trying to express the strange sense of timeless moments which arises when one is no longer trying to resist the flow of events, the peculiar stillness and self-sufficiency of the succeeding instants, when the mind is, as it were, going along with them and not trying to arrest them. A similar view is expressed thus by Madzu. A sutra says, it is only a group of elements which come together to make this body. When it arises, only these elements arise. When it ceases, only these elements cease. But when these elements arise, do not say, I am arising, and when they cease, do not say, I am ceasing. So too with our former thoughts, later thoughts, and intervening thoughts or experiences. The thoughts follow one another without being linked together. Each one is absolutely tranquil. End of quote. Buddhism has frequently compared the course of time to the apparent motion of a wave, wherein the actual water only moves up and down, creating the illusion of a piece of water moving over the surface. It is a similar illusion that there is a constant self moving through successive experiences, constituting a link between them in such a way that the youth becomes the man, who becomes the greybeard, who becomes the corpse. Connected, then, with the pursuit of the good is the pursuit of the future. The illusion whereby we are unable to be happy without a promising future for the symbolic self. Progress towards the good is therefore measured in terms of the prolongation of human life, forgetting that nothing is more relative than our sense of the length of time. A Zen poem says, the morning glory, which blooms for an hour, differs not at heart from the giant pine, which lives for 1,000 years. Subjectively, a gnat doubtless feels that its span of a few days is a reasonably long lifetime. A tortoise with its span of several hundred years would feel subjectively the same as the gnat. Not so long ago, the life expectancy of the average man was about 45 years. Today it is from 65 to 70 years. But subjectively, the years are faster, and death, when it comes, is always all too soon. As Dogen said, the flowers depart when we hate to lose them. The weeds arrive while we hate to watch them grow. This is perfectly natural, perfectly human, and no pulling and stretching of time will make it otherwise. On the contrary, the measuring of worth and success in terms of time, and the insistent demand for assurances of a promising future, make it impossible to live freely both in the present and in the promising future, when it arrives. For there is never anything but the present, and if one cannot live there, one cannot live anywhere. The Shobogenzo says, when a fish swims, he swims on, and there is no end to the water. When a bird flies, he flies on, and there is no end to the sky. From the most ancient times, there was never a fish who swam out of the water, nor a bird who flew out of the sky. Yet when the fish needs just a little water, he uses just a little, and when he needs lots, he uses lots. Thus the tips of their heads are always at the outer edge of their space. If ever a bird flies beyond that edge, he dies, and so also with the fish. From the water the fish makes his life, and from the sky the bird, but this life is made by the bird and the fish. At the same time, the bird and the fish are made by life. Thus there are the fish, the water, and life, and all three create each other. Yet if there were a bird who first wanted to examine the size of the sky, or a fish who first wanted to examine the extent of the water, and then try to fly or to swim, they will never find their own ways in the sky or water. End of quote. This is not a philosophy of not looking where one is going. It is a philosophy of not making where one is going so much more important than where one is, that there will be no point in going. The life of Zen begins, therefore, in a disillusion with the pursuit of goals which do not really exist, the good without the bad, the gratification of a self which is no more than an idea, and the morrow which never comes. For all these things are a deception of symbols pretending to be realities, and to seek after them is like walking straight into a wall upon which some painter has, by the convention of perspective, suggested an open passage. In short, Zen begins at the point where there is nothing further to seek, nothing to be gained. Zen is most emphatically not to be regarded as a system of self-improvement, or a way of becoming a Buddha. In the words of Lin Ji, if a man seeks the Buddha, that man loses the Buddha. For all ideas of self-improvement, and of becoming or getting something in the future, relate solely to our abstract image of ourselves. To follow them is to give ever more reality to that image. On the other hand, our true non-conceptual self is already the Buddha and needs no improvement. In the course of time it may grow, but one does not blame an egg for not being a chicken. Still less does one criticize a pig for having a shorter neck than a giraffe. A Zen Rin poem says, in the landscape of spring there is neither high nor low. The flowering branches grow naturally, some long, some short. When Sui Wei was asked about the meaning of Buddhism, he answered, wait until there is no one around, and I will tell you. Sometime later, the monk approached him again, saying, there is nobody here now. Please answer me. Sui Wei led him out into the garden, and went over to the bamboo grove, saying nothing. Still the monk did not understand. So at last, Sui Wei said, here is a tall bamboo, there is a short one. Or, as another Zen Rin verse puts it, a long thing is the long body of Buddha, a short thing is the short body of Buddha. What is therefore to be gained from Zen is called wushu, Japanese buji, or nothing special, for as the Buddha says in the Vajracchajika, I obtained not the least thing from unexcelled complete awakening, and for this very reason it is called unexcelled complete awakening. The expression wushu also has the sense of the perfectly natural and unaffected, in which there is no fuss or business. The attainment of Satori is often suggested by the old Chinese poem, Mount Lu in misty rain, the river Che at high tide. When I had not been there, no rest from the pain of longing. I went there and returned. It was nothing special. Mount Lu in misty rain, the river Che at high tide. According to the famous saying of Qing Yuan, before I had studied Zen for 30 years, I saw mountains as mountains and waters as waters. When I arrived at a more intimate knowledge, I came to the point where I saw that mountains are not mountains and waters are not waters. But now that I have got its very substance, I am at rest. For it's just that I see mountains once again as mountains, and waters once again as waters. The difficulty of Zen is, of course, to shift one's attention from the abstract to the concrete, from the symbolic self to one's true nature. So long as we merely talk about it, so long as we turn over ideas in our minds about symbol and reality, or keep repeating, I am not my idea of myself, this is still mere abstraction. Zen created the method, upaya, of direct pointing in order to escape from this vicious circle, in order to thrust the real immediately to our notice. When reading a difficult book, it is of no help to think, I should concentrate. For one thinks about concentration instead of what the book has to say. Likewise, in studying or practicing Zen, it is of no help to think about Zen. To remain caught up in ideas and words about Zen is, as the old masters say, to stink of Zen. For this reason, the masters talk about Zen as little as possible, and throw its concrete reality straight at us. This reality is the suchness, ta-ta-ta, of our natural, non-verbal world. If we see this just as it is, there is nothing good, nothing bad, nothing inherently long or short, nothing subjective, and nothing objective. There is no symbolic self to be forgotten, and no need for any idea of a concrete reality to be remembered. A monk asked Zhao Zhu, "For what reason did the first patriarch come from the West?" This is a formal question asking for the central point of Bodhidharma's teaching, that is, of Zen itself. Zhao Zhu answered, "The cypress tree in the yard." "Aren't you trying," said the monk, "to demonstrate it by means of an objective reality?" "I am not," retorted the master. "For what reason, then, did the first patriarch come from the West?" "The cypress tree in the yard." Notice how Zhao Zhu whips the monk out of his conceptualization about the answer. When Tung Shan was asked, "What is the Buddha?" he answered, "3 pounds of flax." Upon this, Yuan Wu comments, "Various answers have been given by different masters to the question, 'What is the Buddha?' None, however, can excel Tung Shan's 3 pounds, jin, of flax, as regards its irrationality, which cuts off all passage of speculation. Some comment that Tung Shan was weighing flax at the moment, hence the answer. Still others think that as the questioner was not conscious of the fact that he himself was the Buddha, Tung Shan answered him in this indirect way. Such are all like corpses, for they are utterly unable to comprehend the living truth. There are still others who take the 3 pounds of flax as the Buddha. What wild and fantastic remarks they make." End of quote. The masters are resolute in cutting short all theorizing and speculation about these answers. Direct pointing entirely fails in its intention if it requires or stimulates any conceptual comment. Fa Yen asked the monk Xuan Zhu why he had never asked him any questions about Zen. The monk explained that he had already attained his understanding from another master. Pressed by Fa Yen for an explanation, the monk said that when he had asked his teacher, "What is the Buddha?" he had received the answer, "Bing Ding Tung Zhu comes for fire." "A good answer," said Fa Yen, "but I'm sure you don't understand it." "Bing Ding," explained the monk, "is the god of fire. For him to be seeking for fire is like myself seeking the Buddha. I'm the Buddha already, and no asking is needed." "Just as I thought," laughed Fa Yen. "You didn't get it." The monk was so offended that he left the monastery, but later repented of himself and returned, humbly requesting instruction. "You ask me," said Fa Yen. "What is the Buddha?" inquired the monk. "Bing Ding Tung Zhu comes for fire." The point of this mondo is perhaps best indicated by two poems submitted by the Pure Land Buddhist Ippen Shonin to the Zen master Hoto, translated by Suzuki from the sayings of Ippen. Ippen was one of those who studied Zen to find a rapprochement between Zen and the Pure Land school, with its practice of repeating the name of Amitabha. In Japanese, the formula is Namu Amida Butsu. Ippen first presented this verse. "When the name is uttered, neither the Buddha nor the self there is. Namu Amida Butsu. The voice alone is heard." Hoto, however, felt that this did not quite express the point, but gave his approval when Ippen submitted a second verse. "When the name is uttered, neither the Buddha nor the self there is. Namu Amida Butsu. Namu Amida Butsu." Bojang had so many students that he had to open a second monastery. To find a suitable person as its master, he called his monks together and set a pitcher before them, saying, "Without calling it a pitcher, tell me what it is." The head monk said, "You couldn't call it a piece of wood." At this, the monastery cook kicked the pitcher over and walked away. The cook was put in charge of the new monastery. Note: however, as Wu Men comments, he fell right into Bojang's trap, because he exchanged an easy job for a difficult one. End of note. One of Nan Chuan's lectures is worth quoting here. "During the period, Kalpa, before the world was manifested, there were no names. The moment the Buddha arrives in the world, there are names, and so we clutch hold of forms. In the great Tao, there is absolutely nothing secular or sacred. If there are names, everything is classified in limits and bounds. Therefore, the old man west of the river that is, Madzu, said, "It is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not a thing." End of quote. This, of course, reflects the doctrine of the Tao Te Ching, that the nameless is the origin of heaven and earth, naming is the mother of the 10,000 things. But Lao Tzu's nameless and Nan Chuan's Kalpa of the void, before the manifestation of the world, are not prior to the conventional world of things in time. They are the suchness of the world, just as it is now, and to which the Zen masters are directly pointing. Bojang's cook was living wide awake in that world, and answered the master's problem in its concrete and nameless terms. A monk asked Sui Wei, "For what reason did the first patriarch come from the West?" Sui Wei answered, "Pass me that chin rest." As soon as the monk passed it, Sui Wei hit him with it. Another master was having tea with two of his students when he suddenly tossed his fan to one of them, saying, "What's this?" The student opened it and fanned himself. "Not bad," was his comment. "Now you," he went on, passing it to the other student, who at once closed the fan, scratched his neck with it. This done, he opened it again, placed a piece of cake on it, and offered it to the master. This was considered even better, for when there are no names, the world is no longer classified in limits and bounds. There is no doubt some parallel between these demonstrations and the viewpoint of Korsipskin semantics. There is the same stress on the importance of avoiding confusion between words and signs on the one hand, and the infinitely variable, unspeakable world on the other. Class demonstrations of semantic principles often resemble types of mondo. Professor Irving Lee of Northwestern University used to hold up a matchbox before his class, asking, "What's this?" The students would usually drop squarely into the trap and say, "A matchbox." At this, Professor Lee would say, "No, no, it's this," throwing the matchbox at the class, and adding, "Matchbox is a noise. Is this a noise?" However, it would seem that Korsipsky still thought of the unspeakable world as a multiplicity of infinitely differentiated events. For Zen, the world of suchness is neither one nor many, neither uniform nor differentiated. A Zen master might hold up his hand to someone insisting that there are real differences in the world and say, without saying a word, "Point to the difference between my fingers." At once it is clear that sameness and difference are abstractions. The same would have to be said of all categorizations of the concrete world, even concrete itself, for such terms as physical, material, objective, real, and existential are extremely abstract symbols. Indeed, the more one tries to define them, the more meaningless they turn out to be. The world of suchness is void and empty because it teases the mind out of thought, dumbfounding the chatter of definition so that there is nothing left to be said. Yet it is obvious that we are not confronted with literal nothingness. It is true that, when pressed, every attempt to catch hold of our world leaves us empty-handed. Furthermore, when we try to be sure at least of ourselves, the knowing, catching subjects, we disappear. We cannot find any self apart from the mind, and we cannot find any mind apart from those very experiences which the mind, now vanished, was trying to grasp. In R. H. Bly's arresting metaphor, when we were just about to swat the fly flew up and sat on the swatter. In terms of immediate perception, when we look for things, there is nothing but mind, and when we look for mind, there is nothing but things. For a moment we are paralyzed, because it seems that we have no basis for action, no ground underfoot from which to take a jump. But this is the way it always was, and in the next moment we find ourselves as free to act, speak, and think as ever, yet in a strange and miraculous new world from which self and other, mind and things, have vanished. In the words of Deshan, "Only when you have no thing in your mind, and no mind in things, are you vacant and spiritual, empty and marvelous." Note, this is Ruth Sasaki's elegant translation, where she points out that in this context, spiritual connotes a state beyond expression in words. End of note. The marvel can only be described as the peculiar sensation of freedom in action which arises when the world is no longer felt to be some sort of obstacle standing over against one. This is not freedom in the crude sense of kicking over the traces and behaving in wild caprice. It is the discovery of freedom in the most ordinary tasks, for when the sense of subjective isolation vanishes, the world is no longer felt as an intractable object. Yin Men once said, "Our school lets you go any way you like. It kills and it brings to life, either way." A monk then asked, "How does it kill?" The master replied, "Winter goes and spring comes." "How," asked the monk, "is it when winter goes and spring comes?" The master said, "Shouldering a staff, you wander this way and that, east or west, south or north, knocking at the wild stumps as you please." The passing of the seasons is not passively suffered, but happens as freely as one wanders in the fields, knocking at old stumps with a stick. In the context of Christianity, this might be interpreted as feeling that one has become omnipotent, that one is God, directing everything that happens. However, it must be remembered that in Taoist and Buddhist thought, there is no conception of a God who deliberately and consciously governs the universe. Lao Tzu said of the Tao, "To its accomplishments it lays no claim. It loves and nourishes all things, but does not lord it over them. The Tao, without doing anything, Wu Wei, leaves nothing undone." To use the imagery of a Tibetan poem, every action, every event, comes of itself from the void, as from the surface of a clear lake there leaps suddenly a fish. When this is seen to be as true of the deliberate and the routine, as of the surprising and the unforeseen, one can agree with the Zen poet Pang Yun. Miraculous power and marvelous activity, drawing water and hewing wood. Chapter 2, Sitting Quietly, Doing Nothing. In both life and art, the cultures of the Far East appreciate nothing more highly than spontaneity or naturalness. Zhu Run. This is the unmistakable tone of sincerity marking the action which is not studied and contrived. For a man rings like a cracked bell when he thinks and acts with a split mind, one part standing aside to interfere with the other, to control, to condemn, or to admire. But the mind or the true nature of man cannot actually be split. According to a Zenrin poem, it is like a sword that cuts but cannot cut itself, like an eye that sees but cannot see itself. The illusion of the split comes from the mind's attempt to be both itself and its idea of itself, from a fatal confusion of fact with symbol. To make an end of the illusion, the mind must stop trying to act upon itself, upon its stream of experiences, from the standpoint of the idea of itself, which we call the ego. This is expressed in another Zenrin poem as, "Sitting quietly, doing nothing, spring comes, and the grass grows by itself." This by itself is the mind's and the world's natural way of action, as when the eyes see by themselves, and the ears hear by themselves, and the mouth opens by itself without having to be forced apart by the fingers. As the Zenrin says again, "The blue mountains are of themselves blue mountains. The white clouds are of themselves white clouds." In its stress upon naturalness, Zen is obviously the inheritor of Taoism, and its view of spontaneous action as marvelous activity, Miao Yung, is precisely what the Taoists meant by the word de, virtue, with an overtone of magical power. But neither in Taoism nor in Zen does it have anything to do with magic in the merely sensational sense of performing superhuman miracles. The magical or marvelous quality of spontaneous action is, on the contrary, that it is perfectly human, and yet shows no sign of being contrived. Such a quality is peculiarly subtle, another meaning of Miao, and extremely hard to put into words. The story is told of a Zen monk who wept upon hearing of the death of a close relative. When one of his fellow students objected that it was most unseemly for a monk to show such personal attachment, he replied, "Don't be stupid. I'm weeping because I want to weep." The great Hak Win was deeply disturbed in his early study of Zen when he came across the story of the master, Yen Tu, who was said to have screamed at the top of his voice when murdered by a robber. Yet this doubt was dissolved at the moment of his satori, and in Zen circles his own death is felt to have been especially admirable for its display of human emotion. On the other hand, the abbot Guizhen and his monks allowed themselves to be burnt alive by the soldiers of Oda Nobunaga, sitting calmly in the posture of meditation. Such contradictory naturalness seems most mysterious, but perhaps the clue lies in the saying of Yin Men, in walking just walk, in sitting just sit. Above all, don't wobble. For the essential quality of naturalness is the sincerity of the undivided mind, which does not dither between alternatives. So when Yen Tu screamed, it was such a scream that it was heard for miles around. But it would be quite wrong to suppose that this natural sincerity comes about by observing such a platitude as, whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with all thy might. When Yen Tu screamed, he was not screaming in order to be natural, nor did he first make up his mind to scream and then implement the decision with the full energy of his will. There is a total contradiction in planned naturalness and intentional sincerity. This is to overlay, not to discover, the original mind. Thus, to try to be natural is an affectation. To try not to try to be natural is also an affectation. As a Zen Rin poem says, you cannot get it by taking thought. You cannot seek it by not taking thought. But this absurdly complex and frustrating predicament arises from a simple and elementary mistake in the use of the mind. When this is understood, there is no paradox and no difficulty. Obviously, the mistake arises in the attempt to split the mind against itself. But to understand this clearly, we have to enter more deeply into the cybernetics of the mind, the basic pattern of its self-correcting action. It is, of course, part of the very genius of the human mind that it can, as it were, stand aside from life and reflect upon it, that it can be aware of its own existence, and that it can criticize its own processes. For the mind has something resembling a feedback system. This is a term used in communications engineering for one of the basic principles of automation, of enabling machines to control themselves. Feedback enables a machine to be informed of the effects of its own action in such a way as to be able to correct its action. Perhaps the most familiar example is the electrical thermostat which regulates the heating of a house. By setting an upper and a lower limit of desired temperature, a thermometer is so connected that it will switch the furnace on when the lower limit is reached and off when the upper limit is reached. The temperature of the house is thus kept within the desired limits. The thermostat provides the furnace with a kind of sensitive organ, an extremely rudimentary analogy of human self-consciousness. Note, I do not wish to press the analogy between the human mind and servo mechanisms to the point of saying that the mind-body is nothing but an extremely complicated mechanical automaton. I only want to go so far as to show that feedback involves some problems which are similar to the problems of self-consciousness and self-control in man. Otherwise, mechanism and organism seem to me to be different in principle, that is, in their actual functioning, since the one is made and the other grown. The fact that one can translate some organic processes into mechanical terms no more implies that organism is mechanism than the translation of commerce into arithmetical terms implies that commerce is arithmetic. End of note. The proper adjustment of a feedback system is always a complex mechanical problem. For the original machine, say the furnace, is adjusted by the feedback system. But this system in turn needs adjustment. Therefore, to make a mechanical system more and more automatic will require the use of a series of feedback systems. A second to correct the first, a third to correct the second, and so on. But there are obvious limits to such a series, for beyond a certain point the mechanism will be frustrated by its own complexity. For example, it might take so long for the information to pass through the series of control systems that it would arrive at the original machine too late to be useful. Similarly, when human beings think too carefully and minutely about an action to be taken, they cannot make up their minds in time to act. In other words, one cannot correct one's means of self-correction indefinitely. There must soon be a source of information at the end of the line which is the final authority. Failure to trust its authority will make it impossible to act, and the system will be paralyzed. The system can be paralyzed in yet another way. Every feedback system needs a margin of lag or error. If we try to make a thermostat absolutely accurate, that is, if we bring the upper and lower limits of temperature very close together in an attempt to hold the temperature at a constant 70 degrees, the whole system will break down. For to the extent that the upper and lower limits coincide, the signals for switching off and switching on will coincide. If 70 degrees is both the lower and the upper limit, the go sign will also be the stop sign. Yes will imply no, and no will imply yes. Whereupon the mechanism will start trembling, going on and off, until it shakes itself to pieces. The system is too sensitive, and shows symptoms which are startlingly like human anxiety. For when a human being is so self-conscious, so self-controlled that he cannot let go of himself, he dithers or wobbles between opposites. This is precisely what is meant in Zen by going round and round on the wheel of birth and death, for the Buddhist samsara is the prototype of all vicious circles. Now, human life consists primarily and originally in action, in living in the concrete world of suchness. But we have the power to control action by reflection, that is, by thinking, by comparing the actual world with memories or reflections. Memories are organized in terms of more or less abstract images, words, signs, simplified shapes, and other symbols which can be reviewed very rapidly one after another. From such memories, reflections, and symbols, the mind constructs its idea of itself. This corresponds to the thermostat, the source of information about its own past action by which the system corrects itself. The mind-body must, of course, trust that information in order to act, for paralysis will soon result from trying to remember whether we have remembered everything accurately. But to keep up the supply of information in the memory, the mind-body must continue to act on its own. It must not cling too closely to its own record. There must be a lag or distance between the source of information and the source of action. This does not mean that the source of action must hesitate before it accepts the information. It means that it must not identify itself with the source of information. We saw that when the furnace responds too closely to the thermostat, it cannot go ahead without also trying to stop, or stop without also trying to go ahead. This is just what happens to the human being, to the mind. When the desire for certainty and security prompts identification between the mind and its own image of itself. It cannot let go of itself. It feels that it should not do what it is doing, and that it should do what it is not doing. It feels that it should not be what it is, and be what it isn't. Furthermore, the effort to remain always good or happy is like trying to hold the thermostat to a constant 70 degrees by making the lower limit the same as the upper. The identification of the mind with its own image is therefore paralyzing because the image is fixed. It is past and finished. But it is a fixed image of oneself in motion. To cling to it is thus to be in constant contradiction and conflict. Hence Yunmen's saying, in walking just walk, in sitting just sit. Above all, don't wobble. In other words, the mind cannot act without giving up the impossible attempt to control itself beyond a certain point. It must let go of itself, both in the sense of trusting its own memory and reflection, and in the sense of acting spontaneously, on its own, into the unknown. This is why Zen often seems to take the side of action as against reflection, and why it describes itself as no mind, wu xin, or no thought, wu nian, and why the masters demonstrate Zen by giving instantaneous and unpremeditated answers to questions. When Yunmen was asked for the ultimate secret of Buddhism, he replied, dumpling. In the words of the Japanese master, Takuan, when a monk asks, what is the Buddha, the master may raise his fist. When he is asked, what is the ultimate idea of Buddhism, he may exclaim, even before the questioner finishes his sentence, a blossoming branch of the plum, or the cypress tree in the courtyard. The point is that the answering mind does not stop anywhere, but responds straightway, without giving any thought to the felicity of an answer. Translated by Suzuki. This is allowing the mind to act on its own. But reflection is also action, and Yin Men might also have said, in acting, just act. In thinking, just think. Above all, don't wobble. In other words, if one is going to reflect, just reflect. But do not reflect about reflecting. Yet Zen would agree that reflection about reflection is also action, provided that in doing it, we do just that and do not tend to drift off into the infinite regression of trying always to stand above or outside the level upon which we are acting. Thus, Zen is also a liberation from the dualism of thought and action, for it thinks as it acts, with the same quality of abandon, commitment, or faith. The attitude of Wuxin is by no means an anti-intellectualist exclusion of thinking. Wuxin is action on any level whatsoever, physical or psychic, without trying at the same moment to observe and check the action from outside. This attempt to act and think about the action simultaneously is precisely the identification of the mind with its idea of itself. It involves the same contradiction as the statement which states something about itself. This statement is false. The same is true of the relationship between feeling and action. For feeling blocks action, and blocks itself as a form of action. When it gets caught in this same tendency to observe or feel itself indefinitely, as when in the midst of enjoying myself, I examine myself to see if I am getting the utmost out of the occasion. Not content with tasting the food, I am also trying to taste my tongue. Not content with feeling happy, I want to feel myself feeling happy, so as to be sure not to miss anything. Whether trusting our memories or trusting the mind to act on its own, it comes to the same thing. Ultimately, we must act and think, live and die, from a source beyond all our knowledge and control. But this source is ourselves, and when we see that, it no longer stands over against us as a threatening object. No amount of care and hesitancy, no amount of introspection and searching of our motives can make any ultimate difference to the fact that the mind is like an eye that sees but cannot see itself. In the end, the only alternative to a shuddering paralysis is to leap into action regardless of the consequences. Action in this spirit may be right or wrong with respect to conventional standards, but our decisions upon the conventional level must be supported by the conviction that whatever we do and whatever happens to us is ultimately right. In other words, we must enter into it without second thought, without the arrière-pensée of regret, hesitancy, doubt, or self-recrimination. Thus, when Yin Men was asked, what is the Tao, he answered simply, walk on. But to act without second thought, without double-mindedness, is by no means a mere precept for our imitation, for we cannot realize this kind of action until it is clear beyond any shadow of doubt that it is actually impossible to do anything else. In the words of Wang Bo, men are afraid to forget their own minds, fearing to fall through the void with nothing onto which they can cling. They do not know that the void is not really the void, but the real realm of the Dharma. It cannot be looked for or sought, comprehended by wisdom or knowledge, explained in words, contacted materially, that is, objectively, or reached by meritorious achievement. End of quote. Now, this impossibility of grasping the mind with the mind is, when realized, the non-action, wu-wei, the sitting quietly doing nothing, whereby spring comes and the grass grows by itself. There is no necessity for the mind to try to let go of itself, or to try not to try. This introduces further artificialities. Yet, as a matter of psychological strategy, there is no need for trying to avoid artificialities. In the doctrine of the Japanese master, Bankei, 1622-1693, the mind which cannot grasp itself is called the unborn Fusho. the mind which does not arise or appear in the realm of symbolic knowledge. Quote, a layman asked, I appreciate very much your instruction about the unborn, but by force of habit, second thoughts, Nian, keep tending to arise, and being confused by them, it is difficult to be in perfect accord with the unborn. How am I to trust in it entirely? Banke said, if you make an attempt to stop the second thoughts which arise, then the mind which does the stopping and the mind which is stopped become divided, and there is no occasion for peace of mind. So it is best for you simply to believe that originally there is no possibility of control by second thoughts. Yet, because of karmic affinity, through what you see and what you hear, these thoughts arise and vanish temporarily, but are without substance. Brushing off thoughts which arise is just like washing off blood with blood. We remain impure because of being washed with blood, even when the blood that was first there has gone, and if we continue in this way, the impurity never departs. This is from ignorance of the mind's unborn, unvanishing, and unconfused nature. If we take second thought for an effective reality, we keep going on and on around the wheel of birth and death. You should realize that such thought is just a temporary mental construction, and not try to hold or to reject it. Let it alone just as it occurs and just as it ceases. It is like an image reflected in a mirror. The mirror is clear and reflects anything which comes before it, and yet no image sticks in the mirror. The Buddha mind, that is, the real unborn mind, is 10,000 times more clear than a mirror, and more inexpressibly marvelous. In its light, all such thoughts vanish without trace. If you put your faith in this way of understanding, however strongly such thoughts may arise, they do no harm. Translation read to the author by Professor Hasegawa. This is also the doctrine of Wang Bo, who says again, if it is held that there is something to be realized or attained apart from mind, and thereupon mind is used to seek it, that implies failure to understand that mind and the object of its search are one. Mind cannot be used to seek something from mind, for even after the passage of millions of kalpas, the day of success would never come. End of quote. One must not forget the social context of Zen. It is primarily a way of liberation for those who have mastered the disciplines of social convention, of the conditioning of the individual by the group. Zen is a medicine for the ill effects of this conditioning, for the mental paralysis and anxiety which come from excessive self-consciousness. It must be seen against the background of societies regulated by the principles of Confucianism, with their heavy stress on propriety and punctilious ritual. In Japan, too, it must be seen in relation to the rigid schooling required in the training of the samurai caste, and the emotional strain to which the samurai were exposed in times of constant warfare. As a medicine for these conditions, it does not seek to overthrow the conventions themselves, but on the contrary, takes them for granted, as is easily seen in such manifestations of Zen as the Cha no Yu, or tea ceremony of Japan. Therefore, Zen might be a very dangerous medicine in a social context where convention is weak, or at the other extreme, where there is a spirit of open revolt against convention ready to exploit Zen for destructive purposes. With this in mind, we can observe the freedom and naturalness of Zen without loss of perspective. Social conditioning fosters the identification of the mind with a fixed idea of itself as the means of self-control, and as a result, man thinks of himself as I, the ego. Thereupon, the mental center of gravity shifts from the spontaneous or original mind to the ego image. Once this has happened, the very center of our psychic life is identified with the self-controlling mechanism. It then becomes almost impossible to see how I can let go of myself, for I am precisely my habitual effort to hold on to myself. I find myself totally incapable of any mental action which is not intentional, affected, and insincere. Therefore, anything I do to give myself up, to let go, will be a disguised form of the habitual effort to hold on. I cannot be intentionally unintentional or purposely spontaneous. As soon as it becomes important for me to be spontaneous, the intention to be so is strengthened. I cannot get rid of it. and yet it is the one thing that stands in the way of its own fulfillment. It is as if someone had given me some medicine with the warning that it will not work if I think of a monkey while taking it. While I am remembering to forget the monkey, I am in a double-bind situation, where to do is not to do, and vice versa. Yes implies no, and go implies stop. At this point, Zen comes to me and asks, if you cannot help remembering the monkey, are you doing it on purpose? In other words, do I have an intention for being intentional, a purpose for being purposive? Suddenly I realize that my very intending is spontaneous, or that my controlling self, the ego, arises from my uncontrolled or natural self. At this moment all the machinations of the ego come to naught. It is annihilated in its own trap. I see that it is actually impossible not to be spontaneous. For what I cannot help doing, I am doing spontaneously. But if I am at the same time trying to control it, I interpret it as a compulsion. As a Zen master said, nothing is left to you at this moment but to have a good laugh. In this moment, the whole quality of consciousness is changed, and I feel myself in a new world in which, however, it is obvious that I have always been living. As soon as I recognize that my voluntary and purposeful action happens spontaneously, by itself, just like breathing, hearing, and feeling, I am no longer caught in the contradiction of trying to be spontaneous. There is no real contradiction, since trying is spontaneity. Seeing this, the compulsive, blocked, and tied-up feeling vanishes. It is just as if I had been absorbed in a tug-of-war between my two hands and had forgotten that both were mine. No block to spontaneity remains when the trying is seen to be needless. As we saw, the discovery that both the voluntary and involuntary aspects of the mind are alike spontaneous makes an immediate end of the fixed dualism between the mind and the world, the knower and the known. The new world in which I find myself has an extraordinary transparency, or freedom from barriers, making it seem that I have somehow become the empty space in which everything is happening. Here, then, is the point of the oft-repeated assertion that all beings are in nirvana from the very beginning, that all dualism is falsely imagined, that the ordinary mind is the Tao, and that there is, therefore, no meaning in trying to get into accord with it. In the words of the Zheng Dao Ge, like the empty sky, it has no boundaries. Yet it is right in this place, ever profound and clear. When you seek to know it, you cannot see it. You cannot take hold of it, but you cannot lose it. In not being able to get it, you get it. When you are silent, it speaks. When you speak, it is silent. The great gate is wide open to bestow alms, and no crowd is blocking the way. End of quote. It was through seeing this that, in the moment of his satori, Hakuin cried out, "How wondrous, how wondrous! There is no birth and death from which one has to escape, nor is there any supreme knowledge after which one has to strive." Or, in the words of Xiang Yan, "At one stroke I forgot all my knowledge. There is no use for artificial discipline, for move as I will, I manifest the ancient way." Paradoxically, nothing is more artificial than the notion of artificiality. Try as one may, it is as impossible to go against the spontaneous Tao as to live in some other time than now, or some other place than here. When a monk asked Ban Ke what he thought of disciplining oneself to attain Satori, the master said, "Satori stands in contrast to confusion. Since each person is the substance of Buddha, in reality there is not one point of confusion. What then is one going to achieve by Satori?" Seeing then that there is no possibility of departing from the Tao, one is like Xuan Zhui's easy-going man who neither avoids false thoughts nor seeks the true, for ignorance is in reality the Buddha nature, and this illusory, changeful, empty body is the Dharmakaya. One stops trying to be spontaneous by seeing that it is unnecessary to try, and then and there it can happen. The Zen masters often bring out this state by the device of evading a question, and then, as the questioner turns to go, calling him suddenly by name. As he naturally replies, "Yes," the master exclaims, "There it is." To the Western reader, it may seem that all this is a kind of pantheism, an attempt to wipe out conflicts by asserting that everything is God. But from the standpoint of Zen, this is a long way short of true naturalness, since it involves the use of the artificial concept, everything is God, or everything is the Tao. Zen annihilates this concept by showing that it is as unnecessary as every other. One does not realize the spontaneous life by depending on the repetition of thoughts or affirmations. One realizes it by seeing that no such devices are necessary. Zen describes all means and methods for realizing the Tao as legs on a snake, utterly irrelevant attachments. To the logician, it will of course seem that the point at which we have arrived is pure nonsense, as in a way it is. From the Buddhist point of view, reality itself has no meaning, since it is not a sign pointing to something beyond itself. To arrive at reality, at suchness, is to go beyond karma, beyond consequential action, and to enter a life which is completely aimless. Yet, to Zen and Taoism alike, this is the very life of the universe, which is complete at every moment, and does not need to justify itself by aiming at something beyond. In the words of a Zen Rin poem, if you don't believe, just look at September, look at October, the yellow leaves falling, to fill both mountain and river. To see this is to be like the two friends of whom another Zen Rin poem says, meeting they laugh and laugh, the forest grove, the many fallen leaves. To the Taoist mentality, the aimless empty life does not suggest anything depressing. On the contrary, it suggests the freedom of clouds and mountain streams wandering nowhere, of flowers in impenetrable canyons, beautiful for no one to see, and of the ocean surf forever washing the sand to no end. Furthermore, the Zen experience is more of a conclusion than a premise. It is never to be used as the first step in a line of ethical or metaphysical reasoning, since conclusions draw to it rather than from it. Like the beatific vision of Christianity, it is a which than which there is no whicher, the true end of man, not a thing to be used for some other end. Philosophers do not easily recognize that there is a point where thinking, like boiling an egg, must come to a stop. To try to formulate the Zen experience as a proposition, everything is the Tao, and then to analyze it and draw conclusions from it is to miss it completely. Like the crucifixion, it is to the Jews, the moralists, a stumbling block, and to the Greeks, the logicians, foolishness. To say that everything is the Tao almost gets the point, but just at the moment of getting it, the words crumble into nonsense. For we are here at a limit at which words break down, because they always imply a meaning beyond themselves, and here there is no meaning beyond. Zen does not make the mistake of using the experience, all things are of one suchness, as the premise for an ethic of universal brotherhood. On the contrary, Yuan Wu says, if you are a real man, you may by all means drive off with the farmer's ox, or grab the food from a starving man. This is only to say that Zen lies beyond the ethical standpoint, whose sanctions must be found not in reality itself, but in the mutual agreement of human beings. When we attempt to universalize or absolutize it, the ethical standpoint makes it impossible to exist, for we cannot live for a day without destroying the life of some other creature. If Zen is regarded as having the same function as a religion in the West, we shall naturally want to find some logical connection between its central experience and the improvement of human relations. But this is actually putting the cart before the horse. The point is rather that some such experience or way of life as this is the object of improved human relations. In the culture of the Far East, the problems of human relations are the sphere of Confucianism rather than Zen. But since the Song Dynasty, 959 to 1278, Zen has consistently fostered Confucianism and was the main source of the introduction of its principles into Japan. It saw their importance for creating the type of cultural matrix in which Zen could flourish without coming into conflict with social order, because the Confucian ethic is admittedly human and relative, not divine and absolute. Although profoundly inconsequential, the Zen experience has consequences in the sense that it may be applied in any direction, to any conceivable human activity, and that wherever it is so applied, it lends an unmistakable quality to the work. The characteristic notes of the spontaneous life are mojo-chu, or going ahead without hesitation, wu-wei, which may here be understood as purposelessness, and wu-shi, lack of affectation or simplicity. While the Zen experience does not imply any specific course of action, since it has no purpose, no motivation, it turns unhesitatingly to anything that presents itself to be done. Mojo-chu is the mind functioning without blocks, without wobbling between alternatives, and much of Zen training consists in confronting the student with dilemmas which he is expected to handle without stopping to deliberate and choose. The response to the situation must follow with the immediacy of sound issuing from the hands when they are clapped, or sparks from a flint when struck. End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.